100 million adults in America live with chronic pain, yet only four medical schools require students to take a course on the subject. With prescription pain medication under fire due to abuse, media focuses on the illegal usage of these substances rather than the enormity of the problem of treating the millions of people who are desperate for relief from pain. The new book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem by Judy Foreman, is a wake-up call for a health problem that affects more people than heart disease, cancer, and diabetes combined. It's a great pleasure to welcome Judy Foreman to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You are a nationally syndicated health columnist who has more than 50 journalism awards. What brought you to this particular subject of pain?
Unfortunately, personal experience. A few years ago, I wound up with excruciating neck pain, initially for no obvious cause, and I had never experienced anything like it. I mean, I, like a lot of women, I'd been through childbirth, and Lord knows that really hurts, but this was excruciating, and unlike childbirth, had much less of a clear cause, and a lot of people didn't believe me, and it didn't go away. So it was very different and very eye-opening.
I was really struck in reading the book because I'm reminded whenever I go into the doctor's office for a problem, one of the first questions that they ask you is rate the pain on a scale from 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And I always have a lot of trouble with that because I don't know what their threshold is versus my threshold and what exactly is a number. That seems like a hard thing to self-diagnose of what your level of pain is.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of questions, good questions, embedded in that one good question. There's so far no objective test for pain, you know, no blood test, no X-ray, although X-rays and MRIs can sometimes tell something's wrong with your back, for instance, although many times they're wrong. There are beginning to be brain scans called functional MRIs that can detect pain, and they're very, very promising, but they're not quite ready for the clinic yet. Plus, they'd be very expensive if you use them on everybody who came into the office with pain. So we're left with this kind of woefully inadequate assessment tool, this 0 to 10 scale. A lot of people have the same question that you have about it, you know, like, is your 10 equivalent to my 10, or is my 5 equal to your 10? You know, how do you compare? And the actual point is not to compare one person to another, but to compare that person to himself or herself sort of over time. Like, I noticed with my pain, a lot of times, it felt like on a scale of 10, it was a 20. It was excruciating. But there were certain things, certain drugs, or at times acupuncture or massage or some other intervention could knock it down to maybe an 8. So the scale is more useful for you compared to you than you compared to me. But that seems counterintuitive to a lot of people.
But it strikes me that it is a question that is asked. It's often one of the first questions that is asked, which seems to be good. So we know people are in pain, and yet how do we solve that problem?
The problem of not really knowing whether they're telling the truth or not?
Well, right. And just overall, meaning it's part of the conversation, but then where does the disconnect start?
Well, there's a lot of points of disconnect. For one thing, as you pointed out, which is one of the main things I discovered doing the research for this book, doctors don't really know that much about pain because they're not taught much about pain in medical school. The median number of hours they get on pain education is 9 across 4 years in medical school. Even veterinary students get more. So when you go to your basic primary care doc's office, they don't really know that much about pain, although there is a lot to be known, and the researchers know it, but that hasn't really made it into the clinic. The other thing is there's a lot of shame and stigma with pain, so you know nobody wants to deal with it unless they have to. So there's a lot of reasons why this is kind of hidden from public view, even hidden from doctors' view, and you know the doctors really don't know whether to believe people or not because of the whole problem of opioid abuse. One of the conclusions I came to is believe your patients, because unless you yourself have felt the kind of excruciating pain that I felt and a lot of people in chronic pain feel, it's very hard to believe, but it really is there, even though it's invisible to the naked eye.
When you think about the stigma, and I think that's interesting because we don't often think of a stigma regarding pain. Why do you think that is an admission that we are in pain?
Well, I mean, there's a whole kind of religious, cultural history to all this. Yeah, I think pain is seen as a weakness. Even more than that, I think, and I would have thought this too, frankly, until I had it myself, that, you know, people who are complaining about in pain, they must be just depressed or it's all in their head. And that is the common view. And I, you know, in doing these interviews, I get that question all the time. You know, aren't people in pain just exaggerating or making it up, or don't they just want attention, or, you know, are they wusses or what? And frankly, I would have thought that too until it happened to me. And a lot of the doctors that I talk about in my book, when they become pain patients, they're stunned to find out that, holy cow, this is really real. And, you know, they didn't know anything about it either, subjectively or objectively. So I think the stigma comes from a lot of these kind of psychological things. But by and large, the pain comes first and then the depression or then the stress. You know, it's pain itself that is the driver.
How do you define chronic pain? How should that be defined?
I was hoping you would ask me that. Pain, in general, I can tell you the official definition, which comes from this academic group called the International Association for the Study of Pain. There are about 9,000 neuroscientists. And they say that pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in terms of such damage. That's kind of a mouthful. As a shorthand definition of chronic pain, it's pain that lasts from at least 3 to 6 months and often many more months and years. But what actually happens is that chronic pain is not just acute pain that doesn't go away. That's sort of the most important take-home message I hope your listeners can hear. It is not just acute pain that doesn't go away. It becomes a disease of the nervous system in its own right, a disease that's not just chronic pain is not just a symptom of something else, a tumor or an infection, although it can be, but often it is a transformation of the nervous system into a kind of a runaway freight train. The nervous system literally transforms when acute pain becomes chronic pain. And the sensory nerves get better and better, or better sounds good, get more and more efficient at transmitting pain signals up to the brain. It's a little like learning French or learning to play the piano. The more practice you get, the more efficient you get at it. And that's what happens with pain. The signals get to the brain with less and less interference, and they become like a runaway freight train. So acute pain is really a totally different animal at the biochemical level from acute pain.
When you think about the overall problem of pain and ultimately pain management, you talk about, and I mentioned this in the introduction, the media and their discussion and focus often on the abuse of the pain products. I would like to just talk a moment. Are the items that we have in our utility belt to counter pain, are they effective enough?
No. It's a short answer. No one is effective enough. Combining a lot of different things can be fairly effective. Overall, and this may surprise people, opioids, which we used to call narcotics, and they are in a lot of the prescription painkillers, they reduce pain about 30 to 40%, which is huge in the sense that if your pain is a 10 and it can get knocked down to a 6 or a 7, you've still got it and you still know you've got it, but you may be able to do your job or raise your kids with that. I mean, it's significant, but not good enough. Interestingly, marijuana seems to reduce pain almost as much, about 30%. And a lot of other things reduce it less, but it can add up. Like acupuncture can be fairly effective. Exercise is tremendously effective. And basically, we're talking here about non-cancer pain, a lot of orthopedic type pain. Massage can help with things like back pain. Chiropractic, the data is somewhat mixed, but people who love it, love it. And, you know, meditation can significantly reduce the experience of pain. The data, including the brain scans, suggest that meditation helps you kind of dissociate your emotional response to pain from the sensory part of pain. So you know it's there, you know it hasn't gone away, but you're a little less enmeshed with it emotionally, which can help you get through your day better. So there are a lot of things that taken together can make a dent in it. But as far as a cure, we don't have a cure yet, although I tell you, as a science writer, a lot of the science that's coming along is pretty exciting, but we're not there yet.
Judy Foreman is the author of the new book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Again, I mentioned in the introduction about physicians getting practically no pain education. You make the point in the book that veterinarians get more.
Yes. It's pathetic, but it's true.
Why do you think that's the case?
You know, I don't know. There's been a very good pain curriculum available for a number of years from this group, the International Association for the Study of Pain. As one doctor told me, medical schools are the last bastion of feudalism in America. It's very turfy. The professors have their chunk of time that they're allotted to give students their wisdom, and no one wants to give up his or her turf somebody else could teach about pain. And it's a very kind of stodgy system. There are some proposals to change that, specifically if you taught on the exams that medical students have to take when they're done with medical school and at a couple of later points in their careers, if you included more questions about the basic mechanics of pain and what to do about it, then schools would have to teach it because their students would flunk and the schools would lose their accreditation. So that's kind of a sledgehammer approach, but it may come to that because pain is such a big problem and medical schools are really not doing enough about it.
You have discussed and you talk about in the book at great length about how little we do as far as research and pain research. And what more do you think needs to be done? And are there avenues that are there and paths that we should be taking that we're just ignoring?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. You know, the medical school system does a poor job of pain. So does the federal government. It gives the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is kind of the premier research institution, biomedical research institution in the country, they spend only 1.1% of their massive budget on pain research. You know, chronic pain is a disease unto itself, and yet there is no institute on pain at the NIH. There's an institute for practically any other disease you could name. So the problem is pain is, and I've had doctors come right out and say this, pain is an orphan. It is nobody's job. It is nobody's responsibility in the federal government. There's no line item in the budget for it. There are a couple of fairly powerless committees that are trying to make some headway on getting more money for pain, but it's nobody's baby, and I think it should be. And actually, I think it has the potential to be a bipartisan issue because pain obviously doesn't vote Republican or Democratic. It can strike anybody. But getting headway, you know, it comes back to Congress, which basically the whole country is very frustrated with. But that is where the money would have to come from. And more than that, I think the emotional commitment, because people still kind of scorn people with pain. And that it sort of comes down to that negative view of the problem and negative view of the people who have it.
And that negative view, and ultimately, I guess the one thing that doesn't add up to me is that so many people have it, and yet so little is being done. So that's the head scratcher.
Right. And yeah, it is.
and you would think then, is it because pain, and I was thinking about this as I was reading the book, that is it because pain is just sort of implied with many other illnesses and accidents?
Well, that's I'm glad you find this a head scratcher, because I spent 5 years scratching my head about this. How can a problem this big be so undertreated and so ignored and essentially scorned or dismissed? You know, it is a conundrum. It really, really is. You put your finger right on it. I think part of it has to do with the stigma, but part of it has to do with a relatively new recognition by the neuroscientists, the people who study the brain and the nervous system, that pain is its own disease. It's not just a symptom of something else. Because it has been thought of as a symptom of cancer or infection or something else, it's kind of gotten scattered around all the research institutes at NIH and in academic departments around the country. It's kind of nobody's main problem, and yet it actually is 100 million Americans' main problem. But it has been kind of scattered and parceled out as if it were intrinsically a part of these other diseases, when actually it's now known to be a disease unto itself. So that's kind of the conceptual hurdle that, unless you're in the field, you haven't jumped over that hurdle.
And not to overstate it, but you make the point in the book that according to some medical ethicists, that failure to manage pain is really equal to a degree of torture.
Yeah, they call it torture by omission. And I think that's a good phrase, because it's the failure to do something that could alleviate pain. We kind of tend to think that people who are in pain should just kind of deal with it and live with it. And many people do. But the idea is that we could do more about it, even with the drugs we've got, even with the opioids that we've got. And granted, the abuse problem is serious, but the even bigger problem is mismanaged or untreated or unrecognized by the medical establishment, chronic pain. And, you know, many, many pain patients take these opioid drugs for a number of years, and unlike the abusers, they don't really become addicted. They don't keep upping their doses. They don't rob CVSs to get more of the stuff. If anything, they tend to under-medicate themselves, because they often don't like the side effects, which are also a problem. So it's almost like we have two different populations. We have the population of what I call the legitimate pain patients, who aren't being treated aggressively enough and appropriately enough. And then there are the abusers, who get the drugs illegally and misuse them. And that's giving the whole, all the drugs a bad name. And that's just really a shame, because it's sort of like punishing the wrong people.
We've been talking a lot about drugs and about pharmaceuticals and even touching on medicinal marijuana. What about surgery? What about surgery and injections that are often promised to offer pain relief?
Boy, in general, my take on that is don't leap. A lot of the injections, and I actually should say I had steroid injections in my neck for my pain, and I swear it helped me. But then when I was writing the book and looking at the data, it's really very, very far from a slam dunk. And there's a lot of money to be made by doctors who are pejoratively called needle jockeys, who just shoot people up with various types of injections. They work sometimes. They also don't work a lot of the time. So they're not a slam dunk. Surgery, when it works, it's great, but often it doesn't. And there's a whole syndrome called failed back surgery, surgery that was either done wrong or shouldn't have been done in the first place because it was a solution that didn't fit the problem. And a lot of times the surgery is not as effective as people would like. As one surgeon said to me, you know, I am a surgeon, I have a hammer, therefore you are a nail. But the problem is the patient isn't always a nail, and surgery is not always the right solution. So some of these traditional Western treatments are, frankly, kind of disappointing. Electrical stimulation like TENS, TENS, and other things can also help. Spinal cord stimulation can help somewhat. But again, those, especially the invasive things, are not trivial procedures. I mean, they're, you know, you can get an infection, or the implant can migrate. I mean, there are problems with almost every treatment that you could imagine. We shouldn't end on a down note.
No, and I don't want to. In fact, I wanted to say you use the term slam dunk, and one of the slam dunks that you talk about is
exercise.
I mean, that's the real. That is, if there's one thing to look at as the closest thing that we have to a magic bullet, that would be it.
That's exactly right, and that was the most happy and optimistic chapter I did in the whole book. The problem with exercise is that the big problem with exercise, period, in this country, a lot of people don't do it. It's kind of a bimodal distribution. There are a lot of people like me who love to do it, and it's the high point of their day, and they do it no matter what, and a lot of people who can't get off the couch. But exercise, A, is a huge way to prevent a lot of back pain and neck pain. People who exercise are at much, much, much lower risk of getting chronic pain in the first place. And once you've got it, exercise is often the treatment. It's not always totally clear why, but as I was explaining before, how acute pain can turn into chronic pain because the nervous system essentially revs itself up into a kind of a continuous feedback loop, what exercise seems to do is kind of reverse that process somewhat. It kind of desensitizes the nervous system. So you get used to a little pain and you realize, and this is kind of a cognitive and emotional thing, that, you know, yeah, it hurts a little bit to exercise, but it didn't cause tissue damage, which is what people fear, and you actually feel better afterwards, and then you can sort of create a positive and, you know, a forward-looking feedback loop. The problem is getting people to do it. And that's so frustrating because it's free, it's easy. You know, once you get into it, it's actually can be enjoyable, and it's the one thing that people should really be doing for themselves.
The name of the book is A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Judy Foreman is the author. It's published by Oxford University Press. Judy, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, A Nation in Pain, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.